Okay, welcome ladies and gentlemen to the Science Media Centre briefing on food insecurity. Before we begin, can I please ask you, if you haven't done so already, to enter the four-digit PIN number you'll see in the top left-hand side of your screen. Just punch the number in into your telephone keypad, followed by the hash key to sync up the audio and online component of the briefing. We have two speakers for you today, both of whom are presenting over the next couple of days at the Dietitians New Zealand Conference being held at the University of Otago in Dunedin. The speakers will talk for about 10 to 12 minutes each, and we'll finish things off with a Q&A session, so please hold your questions to the end of the briefing, or if you'd like to line up one beforehand, you can enter it in the chat box on the left-hand side of your screen. Now, you've probably heard and written about the concept of food security. This refers to the availability of food and one's access to it. A household is considered food secure when its occupants do not live in hunger or fear of starvation. Food security is really talked about in the context of developing nations, where in many cases people are actually starving. But there's also evidence suggesting some people in developed countries like New Zealand and Australia do not have access to affordable, healthy foods. So this is so-called food insecurity. Professor John Coveney was instrumental in putting together a study in South Australia a few years ago called the Adelaide Healthy Food Basket, a survey on food cost, availability and affordability in five local government areas in metropolitan Adelaide. The aim of John's study was to compare the cost, availability and affordability of a standardised healthy food basket in parts of Adelaide. So John will talk about this study and give some observations on the New Zealand situation. So John is the Associate Dean of the School of Medicine at Flinders University in Adelaide. Our second speaker, Claire Smith, is a researcher at the University of Otago's Department of Human Nutrition, where she will complete her PhD this year. She's worked as a nutritionist, including for a British supermarket chain. Claire has been working on two studies at Otago, the SPEND study and the Family Food Environment Survey. The latter one will be the subject of her presentation today. So I'll hand over now to John to begin the presentation. John.
Thank you very much, Peter, and greetings, everybody, from... I'm here in sunny Adelaide, greetings from sunny Adelaide. I want to talk about the research that we've been conducting here in South Australia, starting in 2004 with the study that Peter described there, which was really a pilot study. But the study that I'm going to move on to is one that broadened out on that pilot study to collect data from across Adelaide, not just in the four local government areas that we initially started in. So that's what I want to talk to you about today, because I think it has major implications for food security and I've just pressed the wrong button, so let me do that again. Okay, I think it has major implications for food insecurity and food policy in South Australia. So the backdrop to all of this really is the recognition that there is a social gradient for almost every health problem that we know about. What I mean by a social gradient is that we can see, using the data on the slide that I've just put up, that for some social groups, they're more likely to experience certain health problems in degrees which are greater than other social groups. So the slide that I've just put up relates to the proportion of South Australian adults who have a healthy weight in various socioeconomic groups. And from that, you can see that the group in the highest 20% by way of income are more likely to have a healthy weight compared to the group in the lowest 20% by income. And you find this relationship for virtually every health behaviour. So if we were talking about servings of fruits and vegetables that people were eating, you're more likely to find larger numbers of servings consumed by people in the highest socioeconomic group compared to the lowest. So almost every health behaviour appears to have this social gradient. So what's going on here in terms of food? Why is it that some groups appear to eat more healthily or unhealthily? What's sitting behind this what I'm calling a social gradient? Well, we've known about this social gradient for many years, and it seems that there are two possible explanations that have been put forward. One explanation is that people in lower socioeconomic groups in more disadvantaged situations simply do not have the amount of knowledge or the education that's necessary in order to eat healthily. The alternative is to question whether people who are disadvantaged actually have ready access, availability and affordability to healthy foods. Certainly in Australia, it's been true that we have tended to go down the education path more than the what I call the structural path. We've had many, many campaigns that have been designed to educate people about eating healthily. And certainly those campaigns appear to have worked, certainly have worked with certain social groups. So it appears that the knowledge that we have been able to provide by way of these campaigns has been picked up readily by people in more advantaged areas and may even have served to widen the health gap because they simply haven't fully engaged with people from more disadvantaged areas. So even in our remote and rural areas, where many of our indigenous communities live, where we know that access to healthy food is really, really difficult because of a whole lot of geographic problems, we haven't fully taken on board the whole issue of access and availability. So we have tended to kind of expect education programs to have provided a solution. But now people are really taking seriously the issues to do with access and availability, and what I want to talk about is this study here, which is called Food Access and Health in South Australia, funded by the South Australian Health Government, Health Department, where we have looked at access, availability and affordability of healthy food right across Adelaide in all of the local government areas. And I haven't got time to talk about the full methodology for you, but basically what we've done is to use this instrument of a healthy food basket, where a number of healthy foods have been costed in different locations throughout Adelaide to see whether there is a difference in the cost of the food in wealthy or less wealthy suburbs, or whether there's a difference in the availability of those foods. And this is really trying to answer the question: is it the case that disadvantaged groups don't eat healthy food because it's simply too expensive for them, it's more expensive in their areas than in other areas, or that food is simply not available? We know that's true for our indigenous population who live in rural and remote areas, but is that also true in metropolitan areas? So we undertook this study with the aim of finding out whether there was a difference in the price of healthy food in different socioeconomic areas in Adelaide and a difference in the availability of healthy food. So that's what we did. And basically we found, that next slide shows you, that there was no difference in the price of food in high-income or low-income areas. We could not find any difference in price. So we couldn't say that healthy food was more expensive on the shelves in low-income areas. So that didn't seem to be an explanation for the difference in eating patterns. Nor was it true that healthy food was less available in metropolitan Adelaide in low-income areas compared to high-income areas. So that was a really interesting finding for us, because it has been the case that some people have believed that this difference between high-income areas and low-income areas is because healthy food is pricier in low-income areas. That's been true in some studies overseas. Certainly in North America, it's been shown that in many disadvantaged areas, healthy food is more expensive, but we weren't able to show that in metropolitan Adelaide. However, what we were able to show was that the affordability of the healthy food basket was very different in the different socioeconomic groups. So for a low-income family, they would have to part with, a typical family would have to part with about 30% of its household income to eat or to buy, I should say, one of these baskets of healthy food, compared to a more wealthy family that would only have to part with about 9% of its income. So 30% of household income would have to be spent by the more disadvantaged families compared to 9% for families who were on better wages. Now, I have to tell you, this isn't an entirely new finding. It goes back a number of years, and I can talk about that. But for every family type, we found that for low-income families, it was less affordable. The healthy food basket was less affordable than for higher-income families. So the question that's then raised is, well, what would be the effects of reducing the price of healthy food? Would that have any impact on whether low-income people ate more of it? And the best work in this area actually comes from New Zealand, a study that was published earlier this year called the SHOP Study, published by researchers from the University of Auckland and the University of Otago in Wellington, where they compared the effects of price reductions on healthy food with the effects of a tailored nutrition education program. And basically what they found was that if you reduced the price of healthy food, if there was a price discount by 12.5%, which is your GST, what you see is an increase in the purchase of healthy food. Whereas if you just tailor nutrition education to these groups, you don't see any effect. So this gives us a really good indication about what might happen if you subsidise healthy food. Breaking that data down, they found that there was a price discount. The price discount of 12.5% actually led to an increase in about half a kilogram of fruit and vegetables per week for the people who were getting that price discount. Now, that's a very, very interesting finding. They also found that while there was a drop-off after they took away the subsidy, there was a hangover effect and people still continued to eat more in the price discount group than in the group that just used education. So it's a very, very important study coming from your part of the world. In my view, probably one of the most important studies in public health nutrition in the past 15 years, because I can't talk about the methodology, but this was absolutely rigidige public health nutrition research. It's got very, very few flaws in it, and I think it's very, very persuasive. So this kind of brings up the question for us here in South Australia. Sorry, I've gone one further. Would a price discount have any effect on food purchasing in South Australia, remembering that the local context in Australia is different from New Zealand? We don't have a GST on food, so we don't have a GST to remove, if you like. So the policy context is quite different here. But still, the question needs to be asked, if we subsidised healthy food in South Australia, would it actually have an impact on purchasing patterns? And would that impact really have an effect on disadvantaged groups? The study in New Zealand really tried to target Māori and Pacific Island groups in that study, and they were able to do that to a large extent. But it's true that many of the people in that study were from European and other backgrounds and not necessarily disadvantaged. So you really have to look at, you know, how disadvantaged groups could really benefit from this. And lastly, what are the numbers here that you need to look at? There could be some really good health economics that looked at the cost of subsidising healthy food, what the cost would be in terms of the overall benefits, because we know that diet-related diseases account for many, many of the health problems that we face in Australia and New Zealand. We're talking diabetes, cardiovascular disease, certain forms of cancer. So what would be the overall costs of that? And that work really does need to be done. And so these are the kind of questions I'm going to be putting to the conference in Dunedin, the Dietitians New Zealand conference that's happening at the end of this week. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, John. I'll hand over now to Claire for her presentation.
Thank you. Greetings from, I'd say, probably grey Dunedin at the moment, but it looks like it's improving. So The question that I'm raising with the Dietitians Association at the conference on Friday is, achieving food security for New Zealand families, how far can behavioural change take us? And so this ties in a little bit, quite a bit with what John was talking about in terms of the drive-by public health nutritionists in the past towards education and knowledge and trying to improve. If we can improve those, we will surely improve the situation in terms of food security. So that's a question I'm asking at the conference. So first of all, what is food security? So access by all people at all times to enough food for an active and healthy life, and includes availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods and the assured ability to acquire foods in a socially acceptable way. So when we're talking about food insecurity, we're talking about the opposite of food security. So you'll probably find that I'm using the two terms interchangeably throughout the talk. So, for example, in New Zealand, the use of food banks or over-reliance on friends or family to obtain their regular food supply could be considered a socially unacceptable way of obtaining food. So, can we measure food insecurity? Well, a lot of this work has been done by one of my supervisors, Associate Professor Winston Parnell. And in New Zealand, we have some really good data from our national nutrition surveys, one which was carried out in 1997 among adults and another one carried out in 2002 among children, whereby we asked households questions regarding food security. And we asked a series of 8 questions. And from answers to these questions, what we can do is categorise households into different levels depending on their food security. And so what we'll find is most of the population will be fully or almost food secure. However, there'll be some people who have to limit the amount of food or the variety of food that they're buying, maybe decreasing the quality and adapting recipes. So they're initiating strategies to improve their situation and making food go further. And then what might happen is some foods might start to run out at the end of the week. And then there could be some stress or anxiety surrounding food provision. And then we start to get down to this very low food security category where households are reducing the quantity of food that they're eating, maybe by skipping meals and reducing portion sizes. And then we have the issue where people are obtaining foods in socially acceptable ways, such as food banks or relying on friends and family. So is this really an issue in New Zealand? I think we've probably, in the past few years, got quite used to some of the headlines which have been coming up in the local papers in terms of food, the use of food banks increasing. And also there's been a lot of talk about not just low-income families using food banks, but also those in that medium-income group starting to use food banks as well. So just looking at data that we've got in New Zealand in terms of the prevalence of food security. So the first row of this table is from the National Nutrition Survey, which was carried out in 1997. And this was among adults. And so we found that 72% were food secure and approximately 1/4 of them with moderate food security and then 4% with low food security. And in the Children's Nutrition Survey, you can see there that there was a higher rate of low food security and moderate food security. And this is because this survey was carried out in households with children where you will find higher rates of food insecurity. So the study which I conducted in 2007 and 2008, which was among families in Dunedin and Wellington, we found a very similar rate of food insecurity in these families. And this was a selection of families across the economic spectrum. But what we did find in this study was that nearly half of the low-income families, and that's that was families with an income less than $30,000, were experiencing food insecurity.